It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now we discuss light pollution, artificial light at night that scientists say disrupt natural wildlife patterns. They affect our sleep cycles, obscure our ability to see the stars, the night sky. Join in on light pollution, its impact on the environment, what you're doing about it. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Bogard is here, Associate Professor of English and Environmental Studies at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of several books on artificial light in the night sky. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here.
Well, tell us a bit about your origin story with light pollution. How did you first become aware of its impact?
Yeah, I mean, I was so lucky. I grew up in Minneapolis, but we've always had a cabin up north, you know, as we say. And so I grew up with that firsthand experience of a real night sky. And later in life, when I was looking for something to write about, I was actually living down in New Mexico and thought, well, I'm going to learn all the constellations. And when I walked outside to see the constellations that I was reading about at the time, I realized quickly that I could not see them because of light pollution. And quickly from there, you start to learn about all the other costs and impacts of from light pollution.
When I think of pollution, the word, I usually think of chemicals leaching into places where they shouldn't be. Can light pollution really be called or classified as a pollution?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that we could talk about. Some people, you know, say that it's not the same kind of pollution, but I like to think of it as something that is getting in the way of our experience of the natural world. We're polluting the sky with light. We're polluting our lives at night with lights. And it's a different kind of pollution, but it's still a pollution.
How do you know that all of the artificial light that we create is affecting the natural world? What do scientists have discovered on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the issue that really drives me the most, is their impact to our fellow creatures and to the natural world. I think the thing that stands out to me is what a biologist told me once, where he said, you know, all life evolved with bright days and dark nights, and we need both. You know, we know that we need light. Light is good for us, but we also need darkness. And there's really no creature that has evolved to, including human beings, to deal with all this artificial light. It has a real impact on animals that are nocturnal. So they've evolved to rely on darkness, essentially, or even crepuscular, those animals that are most active at dawn and dusk. And the light, when we shine it into their habitat, it essentially destroys that habitat for those animals.
So it could really affect bats in particular, I would imagine.
Has a real impact on bats. I mean, the research that we know, some bats seem to benefit from having more light, but most bats don't. And I think that when we talk about the research, the impact to wildlife and animals in the natural world, there is growing evidence, but there's not a ton of evidence about this. But it seems like every new study that comes out confirms this idea that our overuse and misuse of artificial light at night has a real negative impact on the life around us.
If light pollution is getting worse, as they say, what is the culprit? What can we point to that is causing increased light pollution?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. It's, you know, there are more and more of us, so more and more people everywhere, and we bring our lights with us. There's also been a change in technology where we're moving from electric lighting to electronic lighting, namely LED lighting, which... The good part about LEDs is that they are more efficient, and they have great promise in that they could be very programmable, which could help us with the issue of light pollution. But on the negative side, they tend to be brighter and more intense. And so as we switch to LED lights, the problem in many places has just gotten worse.
And there is such, there's a lot of drive and pressure on consumers to switch to LEDs because they are so highly energy efficient and they use a lot less energy than the old, you know, incandescent lights. But that, what I hear from you, is also a tricky trade-off.
Well, I think it is. We can distinguish between sort of the LEDs that we're encouraged to buy for our, inside our homes and that kind of thing. And I would, continue to encourage people to do that. But it's really the LEDs in our streetlights, for example. And unfortunately, the cities that adopted LEDs early are the ones that have caused the most problem, because those LEDs tend to be heavy in what we call blue rich white light. So it's kind of exactly the kind of light that humans and any other form of life doesn't want to see at night, kind of the blue light. The good news is that LEDs are evolving. And so some of the cities that have more recently adopted LEDs have chosen LEDs that are better for us, just essentially warmer light than those first. So there's so many instances with light pollution and our use of light where there are choices to be made. And a big part of what I and anybody else who's interested in this is just trying to help people understand that we do have choices to make about our use of light at night.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk about light pollution, its effects on the world around us. Paul Bogard is here, Associate Professor of English and Environmental Studies at Hamline University. You can join in on light pollution, light trespass, glare, sky glow, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, you talk about cities, and sometimes you hear, mayors and city officials say they want to improve lighting in an area so that it helps make the neighborhood safer with, less crime, so that they're connecting light with less crime. How do you balance street lighting with crime issues and safer streets opposed to the issues around light pollution?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm just chuckling a little because we're actually dealing with that right now in Minneapolis.
I was going to mention, but I was like, oh, I'll let him go there if he wants.
right. Yeah. I think it's important to say that, if anybody who's concerned about light pollution, it's not an issue of let's not have lights. It's an issue of how we're going to use the light, what kind of lights, when we're going to use it, and that kind of thing. So nobody is opposed to having lighting that can increase people's safety. It's just that we tend to take what is actually a pretty complex issue, which is the relationship between light at night and safety and crime and that kind of thing, and reduce it to light is good, dark is bad, and so more light is better. And that just is not, there's no research that would support that. The relationships between having more light and less crime really are not supported. And so the question is, how can we have the light that we want and need, and that helps people feel safer, which isn't the same thing as actually being safer, but it's important, helps people feel safer. How can we have that without making all these other problems that are associated with light pollution worse?
Let's take a call now. Mike in Walworth County. Mike, hi, what's on your mind about light pollution?
Good morning. This is one of my all-time pet peeves. I used to work in a school district, and back in the 20 years ago, we were installing what was called full spectrum lighting. And my mother, when I gave her a full spectrum light, the first thing she told me was she could read better, which is a good thing. But what I find is that when people used to put outdoor lighting, they used to call them bug lights, which are amber. And amber light basically allows you to keep your night vision. The problem with the blue lighting is it's a technical term called scotopic lumens. You lose your night vision. It's similar to having waking up in the morning and turning on your bathroom light. Your retina closes. The biggest problem is with automobiles. When we have these vehicles that have these, I also call it operating room lighting, they can see the road, but the people who are driving in the opposite way get blinded, and I'm surprised there aren't any lawsuits, basically, that this light is blinding other drivers. But it's healthy inside, indoors, where you want to have blue light, where you can have more visual acuity and you can see better. But better light outside actually steals your night vision, because once you're out of that glow, your retinas can't cover. So I would like to encourage the dark sky. There's a group of people that are trying to get dark sky communities, and I think those people should also join in this
band together.
Yes.
Mike, thank you for that. Paul, what are your insights on car headlights and the impact they have?
I mean, I think I've had, like your caller and like I'm guessing a lot of your listeners, have that experience of being blinded by those headlights. And I think something definitely needs to be done about that. It also points to this issue of glare that you mentioned. And that's a great example of how just having brighter lights doesn't automatically make us safer. It actually makes it harder for us to see outside, which is kind of going against the idea of safety.
We have Hamline University Associate Professor and Co-Director of Environmental Studies, Paul Bogard, our guide to light pollution and what to do about it. Join in on what you wonder about the effects of artificial light on humans and animals. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the compounding issues with light pollution from things like car headlights, as we've been talking about, street lamps, offices, outdoor advertising. According to the New World Atlas of Artificial Night Sky Brightness, 99% of Americans and Europeans live under light-polluted sky. By the way, thanks to Matt and Rudolph, who called in to suggest we talk about this issue during our recent caller-only program. Matt concerned about LEDs. Join in what you notice with light pollution, 800-642-1234. We have Hamline University Environmental Studies faculty and author on this issue, Paul Bogard, who stays with us. Let's bring in Tom now in Green Bay. Tom, what are your thoughts?
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. I see a lot of lights being added to the sides of buildings when you're driving down the road. Huge lights just seem to blind you. And there's a code against having light wash, but it doesn't seem to be enforced anywhere. Why isn't that being enforced?
Tom, thank you. Paul, do you have any knowledge there about lights on buildings and code?
I think what he's referring to is the use of what are called wall packs. They're these lights that people put on the sides of buildings. And again, it goes back to this idea of choice. There are different kinds of wall packs. You can get the kinds that your caller's talking about that are, you know, very bright and glary and contribute to the problem. Or you can buy, if you want lights on the side of your building, you can buy lights that are wall packs that are shielded and directed down toward the ground where you actually need the light. So you have a choice there. And then on the issue of enforcement, I think this is a real problem in that, you know, I don't honestly know of any community that has a sort of light ordinance enforcement division or anything like that. So I think, though, that gets to the issue of education. And the more people like your caller who see that kind of thing and object to it and contact their leaders, their community officials and that kind of thing, that's one way that will make a real difference on this problem.
You know, this is the time when people will be putting up holiday lights. Have we gone overboard with these displays?
You could make that case, I guess, in some ways. You know, I really love the holiday lights. I'm a traditionalist. We don't do it until after Thanksgiving here, but I'm excited to put up candles in the windows and some lights outside. So I love it. And I love that display. And again, you know, somebody who's concerned like me with light pollution is not saying, you know, we can't have, you know, holiday lights or something like that. That's not the issue at all. Like, you know, light at night can really be quite beautiful. It's just that in our overuse and misuse of artificial light at night, we create all these other problems.
You know, as we talked about lighting on the sides of buildings, I think about light trespass, which is another type of light pollution, especially if, you know, a neighbor's outdoor lighting is bothering your sleep, or perhaps it's reminding you of like aircraft runway lights. And I know you're not a psychologist, but how do you broach that if your neighbor has light trespass on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think light trespass is such a great issue, great subject for us, because it's such a good example that so many people will immediately think, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's that, you know, the neighbor's light that shines into your house.
Into your bedroom.
Into your bedroom, you know, and, you know, it's unfortunately, we, you know, we put the responsibility on the person whose house is being lit up, like, oh, you're supposed to buy shades and block it out, rather than say, if you're going to use light, you have to control it and, you know, keep it from trespassing on your neighbors. So that is a real issue. I think, you know, in terms of talking to your neighbor, that's a whole can of worms that, you know, I'm sure it's the same in Wisconsin. You know, Minnesotans have a hard time talking about those things, but there's some good advice about that. If you go to the International Dark Sky Association website, which is darksky.org, they have some really good advice about how to broach that subject. And I've heard a lot of success stories where, you know, essentially the neighbor didn't realize that their lights were causing this kind of problem. And once they understood that, they were happy to correct it.
Paul Bogard, our guide on light pollution on the faculty at Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Sharon in Minocqua. Sharon, hi, go ahead.
Hello, hello, good morning. This is such a great topic and it's so close to my heart. I'm a wildlife biologist that worked on two projects, one in Georgia on sea turtles and one in Hawaii on seabirds. And light pollution really is, there's copious amounts of data already demonstrating the impacts of light, artificial light on wildlife, and especially in their migratory patterns. You know, seabirds in Hawaii were colliding directly with light because they were just attracted to them. Animals, you know, as your guest speaker, who's wonderful, mentioned, you know, we all evolved having, you know, daylight hours and then a dark sky. We haven't been able to, understand that this is, you know, that we're having devastating impacts on wildlife. You know, the one thing that I mentioned to your caller, you know, the earlier, is the, we think about more of our impacts of lights on vertebrates, but probably the greatest impact is on nocturnal insects. And it's just devastating for those populations because of disorientation as well as death. And it's also reflective in the decline of all the nocturnal species, which include bats and birds.
Sharon, thank you so much for bringing that to us. Paul, is there anything that you want to add there, Sharon, from that, wildlife biologist perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, this is, you know, the thing that drives me the most. I think a couple things. One is what she says about the impact of nocturnal insects is huge. There seem to be a real decline in insects around the world where they've been studied, and that has ramifications up and down the food chain, really serious issue. And the other thing is the impact of bird migration. We have most birds migrate at night in North America, more than 400 species, and they're often drawn off course by our bright lights. It has a real significant impact. A lot of the birds that run into our windows during the day were drawn off course by our bright lights at night. And so that's where you see the efforts to control lighting in cities during migratory season, especially. And homeowners can be a part of that as well, part of that effort.
We have less than a minute left. Some people might feel unsafe in the dark. What advice would you offer them to become more comfortable with the night?
Yeah, it's in some ways the question, because at kind of a basic level, I think human beings are afraid of the dark. And I think I would encourage people to become educated on the issue and just know that we can have light where we need it, but we don't need to be blasting it up into the sky or into our neighbors' bedrooms, that kind of thing. And that the costs of our overuse and misuse of light are so high. They have such an impact on the life around us. And so let's be good neighbors. Let's use light thoughtfully and responsibly, but not overuse it.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Bogard is an associate professor of English and environmental studies at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of several books on artificial light in the night sky. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a local author's obsession with his favorite snack.
All right. I like to snack just as much as the next person. My go-to? Chips and salsa. And I have a serious weak spot for meat snacks. Jerky, summer sausage. But I met this guy, Jesse, who's taken things to the next level.
My name is Jesse Brookstein, all-around meat geek and author of A Perfect Pair, The History of Landeger in Greene County, Wisconsin.
Did you catch that? He wrote a book about one particular type of snack sausage. I thought it was pronounced Landjager.
But the proper pronunciation is Landjager.
Landjager. Got it. Jesse and I met up at Bavaria Sausage in Madison, Wisconsin, so I could learn a little more. He introduced me to the owner.
My name is Judy Cottrell. I'm the owner of Bavaria Sausage.
Judy's a lifer at Bavaria.
I've been here my whole life because my parents started this business. So I've been peeling wieners since I was 5.
Bavaria's been making sausage in Madison since the early 60s.
So my dad is a master sausage maker, master spice mixer from Bavaria. So these are all authentic Bavarian recipes.
Including the recipe for Landjager, which I asked her to share with our radio audience.
Share the recipe,
yeah.
The ingredients?
You just go ahead and I'll record it.
Yeah. All I'll say is they're all beef, no fillers, no additives, no MSG. Natural hickory smoke.
So that's all we get?
That's all you get.
So what sets Landjager apart?
Landjager is a shelf-stable product. So it goes through a fermentation process in here that drops the pH to such a level that there's no longer any spoilage or pathogenic bacteria in this product.
All right, no refrigeration necessary. They're also kind of flattened, like a long rectangle.
And that's done with these molds or these presses that the Landjager producers have. And not only are they in that rectangular shape, but they also come as a pair. And that's part of the reason I think Landjager stands out as opposed to so many other sausages in the world. Is that unique form and shape.
So let's investigate. First, where'd it come from? I'm guessing Germany?
But it seems like it somewhat spread from what we now know as westernmost point of Austria into Germany, into Switzerland, and into a Swiss, German, French region of France called Alsace.
Okay, and so what about the name?
The direct translation is Landjager is land hunter or country hunter.
Jesse found they were popular among hunters and game wardens hiking around the forests of the region. And later, folks from that region emigrated to the United States and settled in spots like southern Wisconsin and upstate New York, where Jesse grew up. When he moved to Wisconsin, he spotted Landjager all over the place, hanging in their classic chalet-style display cases.
And the geek that I am, I took that childhood relationship I had with it to this adulthood infatuation, I guess you could say it's become, and started researching it, and the book was born.
You found a bunch of makers in Greene County where Swiss immigrants settled in places like New Glarus. And it also led him to Judy at Bavaria Sausage.
I mean, I think we've been making them over 60 years. These have won gold medal in international competition. So, you know, we know they're good, we know they sell, we make a lot of them.
Judy says it's a labor of love, and a dying art.
You know, there's probably a handful of places left like us in the whole United States that really have the family recipes.
But Judy says that tradition extends to her generations of loyal customers, too.
You know, it's something that gets passed on to generation to generation.
So, speaking of passing things on...
One more chance. You want to share the recipe for our listeners?
That would kill my livelihood right there.
Had to try.
So that's pretty much what we do.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. And thanks, Jesse.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
For more on Landjäger and Jesse's book, you can visit his website, KarateFightPublishing.com. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to staying healthy while traveling and tips from a family medicine physician. You might be packing your bags as we speak, and whether you're going by car or plane, we get advice on how to stay healthy while on the go and gathering with other groups. Join in with questions for the doctor, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Danielle Mitchell is SSM Health's Regional Medical Director for Primary Care for Southern Wisconsin. Dr. Mitchell, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're hearing reports from hospitals about higher caseloads of RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. Are more patients coming into your clinics with RSV or other respiratory problems?
Yeah, so we are actually seeing an uptick in cases with RSV, and it's not just here, of course, in Wisconsin, but nationally as well. And for those that are not familiar with RSV, it is a viral infection. It can infect anywhere from, you know, kiddos all the way up into adults. Typically, in most cases, the presentation is with mild upper respiratory symptoms, so that might include fever, cough, people feeling generally fatigued and malaise, but we do are really careful because in kiddos, particularly 2 years of age and less, we can see a more severe presentation that can progress into a lower respiratory infection and pneumonia.
If we're traveling to another part of the country, should we be more concerned about RSV versus, you know, here in the Midwest?
You know, with regards to just overall precautions, I think, you know, we live, I feel like, in a different time period where we're definitely more aware, I think, of, you know, since COVID has occurred, sure, the precautions that we can take. And they're easy precautions, I think, for people to be able to do. The good old tried and true in case of washing hands, not touching face. The reason behind, of course, not touching face is because our face houses most of the mucous membranes where a lot of viral and bacterial transmission will occur. So keeping fingers out of eyes, nose, and mouth is always an excellent idea for multiple reasons. Of course, washing hands in the first place just to keep those pathogens and those viruses and bacteria off of our hands. But also being able to be mindfully aware that if somebody is actively coughing, that's probably somebody that you don't want to be in close proximity to. So that's where, you know, during COVID, of course, the 6 feet of social distancing really kind of was reemphasized. That's always been there with regards to, you know, not trying to catch something from somebody that has an airborne illness. And of course, the other thing that we can do as well is wearing masks. You know, masks are so much about protecting the person next to you. N95s that have a higher filtration capability do also protect others, not only around you, but also yourself as well.
In terms of wearing masks, what are your suggestions for air travel? Would you say wear those masks on the plane?
I would. You know, there's a lot of debate back and forth about, you know, when people are on a plane, you know, what the air quality on the plane is. We do know that those are, the air is to a certain extent recycled and filtered. But we also know, too, that you're sitting in close proximity, probably closer than what you might normally sit next to somebody just in a regular public setting. And so wearing a mask, I think, is always a good idea on a plane, just to protect not only your neighbors, but if you can wear an N95, then that would offer some protection for yourself.
The Food and Drug Administration added amoxicillin last month to its list of nationwide drug shortages. Do you have enough meds on hand to treat, you know, these common childhood illnesses like flu and ear infections and strep throats?
Yeah, so right now we are under a shortage with some of the liquid amoxicillins, and that usually comes up as an issue when we have kiddos that can't either swallow pills or chew pills. And just to remind everybody, you know, antibiotics like amoxicillin are used to treat bacterial infections. A lot of times when we see things like ear infections in kiddos, it starts out as viral. It can go on to a bacterial infection. Right now, we do have adequate supplies to be able to treat people, but we are asking people to be mindful. Antibiotic stewardship and those decisions made behind whether a patient should take antibiotics or not, it's really kind of coming front and center again, not only with shortages pushing this, but just resistance patterns as well that we deal with overall. So, you know, just the idea that not every cough and cold needs an antibiotic, not every ear infection needs an antibiotic, that really is kind of the forefront of messaging when we're talking with patients. And so being mindful, you know, as we're trying to give conservative measures, we definitely want to help people feel better. We have adequate supplies to treat people right now, but we need to be mindful that our supplies are sometimes tenuous, particularly as we live in this endemic phase of COVID and all of the supply chain shortages we're facing.
Are there rapid tests to help determine whether your symptoms are coming from, you know, a viral infection versus a bacterial one?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I trained in the era, and I think that a lot of providers will agree with this, that a lot of the diagnostic accuracy of figuring out what your patient actually has comes from soliciting a great history from them. And so that's why we really kind of discourage when people want to call in, I've got a sore throat, this has always been strep every year, can you just send me my antibiotic? That really then, if that happens, that whole process gets bypassed in terms of soliciting that good history from people, because that's really kind of the first step, right? Mm. So we encourage patients, and we're very good about saying, you know, we need to make sure that we get the appropriate history from you, because it's the first step in diagnosing somebody and probably one of the most important. If somebody's presenting with a constellation of symptoms, let's say high fever, extreme fatigue, muscle aches, back aches, sore muscles, things like that, that might lead the provider to think, oh, this is probably a viral infection and this might actually be flu. So we do have rapid tests to be able to diagnose flu. We also have, you know, the ability to test for strep throat, which is a bacterial infection. Again, the history there is really important. And a lot of times you can actually pinpoint the diagnosis without even doing the tests up front. The same thing, of course, for COVID. We have rapid tests that are available, widely available to the public for free in most cases, to be able to test at home for COVID, which is another great point to make about travel, that if you're going somewhere, you know, you definitely want to be mindful that if you are having any symptoms whatsoever, and especially if you're getting into a car or a plane where other people are going to be in close proximity to you, having that home test available to you can really make the difference between somebody else getting very, very sick versus not.
Dr. Danielle Mitchell with us, SSM Health's Regional Medical Director for Primary Care in Southern Wisconsin, helping us to limit exposure, ease the travel process, tips on how to stay healthy. Join in with your questions about masking, about COVID, about immunizations, and more. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the holiday season that brings people together and how to limit health risks in this busy travel time. AAA predicts roughly 55 million Americans are expected to travel 50 miles or more this Thanksgiving weekend. Join in with questions for the doctor, 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Danielle Mitchell, SSM Health's Regional Medical Director for Primary Care in Southern Wisconsin, stays with us. Dr. Mitchell, when we're going on the road, what medical information and what supplies should people carry while traveling?
Oh, that's a good question. So, of course, as we just talked about previously, making sure that, you know, people, if you're in close proximity to others that you might think are sick, first of all, making the decision to not go would always be something that we would think about, just to not get others sick. Holiday times are times when we see an increased rise, usually in respiratory-borne pathogens as they're passed back and forth at holiday gatherings. Some of those supplies, you know, might include like masks as you're going over to other people's homes, certainly hand sanitizer if you have that available, washing hands actively, of course, while you're at your guest's home. Making sure, too, that you have, you know, if you are traveling overnight, that you have things like Tylenol, children's Tylenol, ibuprofen, all of those things to help people feel more comfortable, I think are great additions to any overnight bag when you're traveling. And, of course, just making sure, too, that you have all of your regular medicines, particularly this time of year with allergies and asthma. The colder, dry weather sets in, and so people who have other illness states like asthma are unfortunately more predisposed to having more severe outcomes than others might have with COVID or flu or RSV. So you're making sure that those medicines, of course, are available and with them in their overnight bag.
In the carry-on, for sure. Also, you know, I would imagine your medical card or any medical history that you might need if you do have to go outside a network for care.
Yeah, absolutely. So in particular, you know, just in terms of emergency preparedness, when it comes to health, it's always a nice idea to have, if you have a significant medical history, and significant medical history can be anything from an allergy to a medicine to, you know, prescription medicines that you might be on. Having some type of medication list in your wallet or your purse is always a good idea. If you have life-threatening allergies, of course, you know, if people have to carry EpiPens, always making sure that you have your EpiPen in your overnight bag, but also listing that and wearing a medical ID bracelet is, of course, very important.
What about moving family gatherings outdoors? Of course, earlier in COVID, that was certainly something people were trying to do. Now it seems gatherings are moving more and more indoors. Do you have any suggestions there?
Yeah, you know, just in terms of prevention and just thinking about even before people go, I mean, we're coming up kind of into the final stretch for Thanksgiving, but the first step is making sure you're vaccinated. People who are vaccinated, of course, can still, in particular with COVID or flu, you can still get viruses that you're vaccinated for, in particular with COVID, but we know the presentation is much less intense. And in most cases, we know that the mortality rate of people who have caught COVID who are vaccinated are much lower than people who are unvaccinated. So we want to make sure that, you know, we take that first step before we even step out the door to make sure that we have our vaccines all up to date. And you can talk to your local healthcare provider with regards to what vaccines are applicable to you in your age category. You know, certainly too, as you're going to other people's homes, you know, just thinking again about making that good decision, you know, should I go if I'm sick? Sometimes people will, decrease the idea like, oh, it's just allergies. But you might not know that before you actually, you know, step out that door into somebody else's home. And so moving those outdoor gatherings to like, or moving the gatherings to an outdoor setting, it can, if it's possible, you know, always a good idea just because the air is not recirculated. But of course, in the Midwest and when we've got freezing temps, you know, that's not always
not
feasible.
Very fun, right? Or feasible.
Yeah, or fun. And then oftentimes, too, it can trigger other illnesses
for people.
Particularly with asthma and allergies. So we have to be mindful of that. But certainly if you have the ability to get fresher, more circulated air, that always, I think, helps. But again, weather permitting with that.
getting advice on safely traveling and gathering with loved ones ahead of Thanksgiving, Dr. Danielle Mitchell in primary care, our guide. You can join in with your questions for the doctor, 800-642-1234. You mentioned vaccines, and the state health department says 27% of Wisconsin residents have received at least one dose of flu vaccines. What questions are surfacing from patients about flu vaccines or COVID boosters? What do you hear?
I think the common one is the misconception that when people get their flu vaccine, that they get the flu from the vaccine. And that's absolutely a falsehood. It's a myth. There are flu vaccines that are intranasal that are live attenuated flu virus, and people can get flu from those. And it's usually typically a mild case because the virus that's contained within flu mist is one of the common intranasal vaccines that we use for flu. It is possible to get influenza from that type of a vaccine, but it's a mild attenuated virus that's in that. So typically symptoms are very mild in those cases. For the actual flu vaccines themselves, it's not even, they don't contain the whole virus. They just contain a very small piece of protein from a virus. That protein has no ability to suddenly replicate into a whole virus. People can have side effects with regards to, you know, headache, sore throat, fevers, sore muscles, but those are all signs that your immune system is working and recognizing that there's been a pathogen introduced, and that's how you form that antibody response to later on protect yourselves. The other instance, too, where people have received their vaccine and then ended up contracting and had a confirmed case of flu is either it's a variant that wasn't covered in the vaccine, or as bad luck would have it, they just got exposed to the flu virus within a period of time right around getting that vaccine. And unfortunately, they haven't formed an immune response to that strain yet.
We have less than a minute left, but what about COVID boosters? Because there's confusion about who gets them and that what they are able to do. The latest COVID booster, can you tell us a little bit about that? We only have about 30, 40 seconds.
Yeah, so the latest COVID booster does cover multiple strains of the COVID virus. We are recommending that if people have eligibility for it to go and get their booster done. We do know that people very quickly reinfect with COVID, so even if you've had COVID, you can still get COVID very soon after having had it. So if you have questions about your eligibility for the vaccine, we definitely recommend that you talk with your healthcare provider.
Dr. Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Dr. Danielle Mitchell is SSM Health's Regional Medical Director for Primary Care for Southern Wisconsin, talking with us about holiday travel and staying healthy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.